This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stachow. Chef Hanan Shabazz was born in Asheville, and with the exception of a brief stint in New York, Asheville is where she has spent much of her life. It's where she first learned to cook and to feed not only her family, but whoever needed to eat. And that link between food and community remains threaded through her culinary career today. So does Asheville's Black history, particularly with the business sector of The Block, where she opened her restaurant during the 1970s. Today, she teaches culinary skills and feeds seniors in need at Southside Community Kitchen. She also serves as a consultant to a new restaurant that honors the legacy of The Block, B'nai on Eagle. Hanan is the 2020 recipient of the Southern Foodways Alliance's Ruth Fertel Keeper of the Flame Award. It honors unsung culinary heroes who uphold Southern food history and tradition. And we're going to try to sing that song today to keep the unsung out of your legacy now as she joins us on The State of Things. Chef Hanan Shabazz, welcome to The State of Things.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me here today.
It's great to have you, and we're going to be talking about your childhood. And I suppose this is a good time to acknowledge that today is your late mother's birthday, and you are one
Yes, it is.
You're one of 10 children. Tell us about your mother. What was she like?
Oh, gosh, my mother was fantastic. I miss her so much, and I'm so grateful that she taught me a lot of things that are definitely benefiting me and so many other people, especially in my family and all my friends and people all over the world has actually had a little fun with Hanan, and it's been a pleasure being able to do that.
Well, you were raised in your grandmother's home. What do you remember about her home?
Oh, my goodness. I live in her home right now today. As a matter of fact, my house burned down in 1984, and she was blind at that time, but she actually gave me her house, and I've been living in her house, trying to follow in her footsteps. Not as big as she used to be, but I'm working on it.
Well, what do you remember about her kitchen?
Well, there was always food. And I remember before living in the house that I live in now, she had one of those stoves that you had to make a fire in, and with the little heater ovens that was over the top would always keep your biscuits warm. And oh, gosh, it's just, I remember all the good things about my grandmother. She just was fantastic. She had birthed 16 children, and we're always down to one child that's left in the world today. And I thank God that she helped raise a lot of other kids and a lot of other children, and people know her from Maine to Spain, basically. Good things.
She's a mother of 16. Your mom was a mother. You were one of 10, right? So that was a lot
yes.
of kids just hanging around that.
And then there were all the neighbors' kids
wow.
that always came because we always had food. And if they needed food or shelter, they was always able to come by and get something to eat. And that is even happening today. I was blessed to have 3 girls. And they blessed me with 8 grandchildren. I have 7 grandsons and 1 granddaughter. So, you know, there's always people at my house just as well.
What about cooking then as you were growing up in that house? Obviously, as you say, a lot of food, a lot of mouths to feed. Were you interested in cooking? Did you have a role in it?
Well, yeah, I always. Now, I have a lot of brothers and sisters myself, and they always wanted to go play or play games or do things like that, but I always stick around my grandmother because she was always in the kitchen making pies or something. I started out, of course, as a little girl making dirt pies, mud pies, you know, those kinds of things that kids don't even do that today, but I remember making mud pies and cookies and things of that nature as a kid, and I thank God that I continued standing beside my grandmother, getting on the stools. She used to call me boot all the time because I'd always have on somebody's boot, and I was standing up on something trying to see what she was doing, and I thank God that I did keep a lot of that good stuff. So
well,
it's
did
been
she,
a pleasure.
Did she let you help out? Because sometimes, you know, if you rule the kitchen and you got a lot of work to do, last thing you need is a helpful 4-year-old, you know?
Well, I know, but unfortunately, I was the one that kind of like my grandmother more than the rest of them. They probably be angry if they hear me say that. But I I hung in there with her. You know what I mean? I really did. She was a big lady. You know, she weighed over 300 pounds most of my life. So there were things that she couldn't do and little places that she couldn't get in that I could get in. So I was always there with her to help her do
and
that.
And again, with all those mouths to feed, you didn't have to feed anybody else. But that house became a kind of hub for the neighborhood as well. Tell us more about that.
Oh, yes, indeed. My father raised hogs. And unfortunately, I've not eaten pork in about 50, almost 60 years now. But he raised hogs, and all the guys in the neighborhood would always want to go with him to feed the hogs, or if they were butchering or slaughtering or whatever, they all did that. I didn't do that part. I did go to the hog pen and play with them sometimes, and make sure they all got fed because they were going to feed us in the long run. So, but my cousins all and their friends, everybody was overwhelmed because my father had a truck. And of course, my brothers was on the back of the truck, and when I could, I would go with them to feed the hogs or whatever. And always they grew vegetables out in those places where the hog pens were, corn and all kinds of things. So I was always around food, and I was always trying to help gather food for a good meal. And we did that. And I still do that. If I could find a field right now that had greens or something in them, I'd take a stool because I can't stand up that much anymore. But I'd take a stool and sit down and pick as long as I could pick all over the garden.
Well, that idea. Then, go ahead.
Then when I got to be old enough, I was doing CNA, and I would take my patients, the people that I was taking care of, and two or three of their friends would want to go pick. And I felt that was good therapy for a lot of the older ladies and gentlemen because it actually kept their hands moving and kept the arthritis down a little bit. Mm-hmm. So it taught me, and I still do that today.
Well, I want to get a little more of your personal history growing up in Asheville, the idea that people were always showing up at your grandma's house and going back and forth helping with chores suggests that Asheville's black community was a pretty close-knit place. You attended Asheville High School in the late 60s, graduated in 68. What was your, because that was right in the midst of integration, so tell us your experience.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Oh, yes. I remember, my mother always had a desire to have somebody graduate from high school, and it turned out to be that I was that person that was going to give my mother a diploma, and I was the first out of her seven children that lived to be able to do that. And that meant a lot to me to be able to give her a diploma because my brothers quit school to help out with my father. He had health issues, and he was an elderly man. As a matter of fact, this was his second family, the family that I came up in, and they... There was always people around. There was always, back in those days, wasn't a lot of jobs. So whatever people could actually do to survive and to get through is what they did. And my father would take a lot of the guys from the neighborhood with him. They would cut trees. They would do all kinds of things. And, of course, feed the animals and just have a good time doing that. And it was a pleasure to see this coming up as I grew to be a woman.
Well,
and
you know,
I thank God.
I was going to say that you know, getting that diploma, as you suggest, was a challenge for economic reasons, as you're describing here, but also social reasons because of the racial tension at the time, right?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. I remember going to school one day and to Lee Edwards High School, and on the steps of the school was a big, in bold, big letters, they wanted us to go back to Africa, you know. And I felt real bad about that. And at that time, I had been involved with, through the Urban Renewal, there was a program. The Neighborhood Youth Corps was available, and I had gotten involved with that and was able to help prepare foods and things for that particular group. And as a matter of fact, we got a chance to go to Raleigh and different places. I was working with a man by the name of Carl Johnson at that time, and he was glad to have me aboard with all of the, I was the youngest of all of them, as a matter of fact. But I hung in there with them, and I went to places, and I was able to see a lot of people and meet a lot of new people in Durham, as well as in Washington, D.C., where I had a chance to sit down with Hubert Humphrey and Robert Kennedy and people like that and share wisdom, knowledge, and understanding. And that was during the Burn Baby Burn era. I remember one night we were at a meeting there, and they had complete darkness in the room, and everybody just flicked their Bic. The only light we had in there at that time was Bic lighters. And I can remember the joy and the happiness that it brought to me and a lot of other young people that was there along with me. And it's just been one thing after another that I learned, I grew, and I'm still growing right now today.
Asheville chef, food historian, and culinary mentor Hanan Shabazz will talk more about her journey outside of Asheville and then back when my conversation continues on The State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is The State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Hanan Shabazz. When she left her hometown of Asheville after high school, she had dreams of finding her calling card in New York City. And then she heard another call, and cooking was a big part of it. Hanan is my guest this hour. She's chef, director of Southside Community Kitchen, and a culinary mentor at Bene on Eagle in Asheville. Well, let's talk about leaving Asheville, because I know, you know, as I said, this was a difficult time, clearly, a time of integration at the high school. You were there. Even some of you and your classmates staged a walkout in high school, but you did get that diploma. And then you decided, and you decided to leave Asheville, and I understand that there was a monkey that played a role in that. Tell us that story.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. My friend who graduated with me, who is no longer with us now, had the pleasure of coming to Asheville, and I was living with my grandmother, and I asked her at that time if I could go to New York. And she said, well, we don't have no money for you to go to New York. And I said, well, if I get the money, can I go to New York? Because I had accomplished what I had meant to do, and that was to give my mother and my grandmother the opportunity to say that I was a graduate from high school. And I actually, one day she came by and we took the monkey out in the street, and I sing a little bit, so I actually had a chance to sing, and we had the monkey to do little jigs on the street corners and things, and got enough money to catch the train. We had a train here on Depot Street, and I had a pleasure of being able to take the monkey out, and the monkey would be doing his little dances, and people was amazed to see a monkey, of course, here in Asheville. We didn't have things like that around here. So they helped me get enough money to buy a train ticket and to go to New York.
And what were what were your plans then when you got to New York?
Well, actually, I was just going to New York. I was hoping that I would be able to get a job there, and I did get a job as a teletypist with AT&T. And when we got back to New York, when I got to New York, of course, we was on a train, and the people on the train was amazed to see a monkey on the train with us. And we are still collecting money. They were just feeling like they just needed to, maybe I looked like I needed a little money, but they gave it to me, and I was able to be able to get to New York. And when we got there, I guess all the excitement and everything with the monkey got away from us. And I really hated that fact that the monkey did get away from us, because I didn't get a chance to really spend a lot of time with him. But his name was Tiger. And even though he was such a little thing, we called him, gave him a big name, the name of Tiger. And we just had a good time while I could be with the monkey and have the monkey around. Brought a lot of people. I got to meet a lot of people when the monkey was there.
Yeah.
But it was just joy and happiness. I got a job with as a teletypist, like I said. And then I started, I was always cooking. There was always guys around who, in the city, of course, women didn't know anything about cooking grits and things of that nature. So all my friends would bring their women by my house on Sunday and so that I could actually teach them how to cook. And that was a pleasure for me. I was able to meet a lot of different kinds of people, all kinds of people from New York, New Jersey, places like that. And but it was just fun being able to do that. It was amazing to me that they didn't know anything about grits at that time.
Wait, that is interesting because I want to interrupt you there only because you're a historian as well, and we're going to talk about the value of keeping these traditions alive. And it's interesting that even by the late 60s, because the migration was to some extent, it had slowed down, but to a trickle perhaps. But even by then, some of that memory had been lost in a place like New York City.
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed. I got with a group because, like I said, I sing a little bit. And when I would go to the studio to sing, they would always want me to bring some food, of course. And I would do that. Or if there was a kitchen available, then I would fix something to eat. And everybody, of course, was able to get some of the food. And at that time, I didn't really have a lot of knowledge of what I was doing, but evidently, I made the food taste pretty good, so they all came to get some every day. And that became one of the things that I was doing. I was singing, dancing, doing whatever I needed to do to try to get through, and it was a blessing to be able to do that.
It seems a little unfair that you had to sing for their supper, but there you go.
Well, I know. I know.
You also, this is when you became interested in the Nation of Islam, right?
Yes. I had heard about the Nation of Islam, of course, here in Asheville, but I got a chance to go to a mosque, and I loved the beauty that I saw there with the way that the women and the children were elevated and cultivated and taught, and it just made me feel as though that was priceless to me. I love that, and I love the way that the protection of the black woman and it made me appreciate my mother and my grandmother and all of the women that was in my life at that time even more so.
And
being
this
able
was,
to see.
Forgive me for interrupting, but this was Mosque Number 7, right? So some celebrated figures were members of that mosque when you were going, right?
Yes. I had a chance to meet Minister Farrakhan and a lot of the other brothers and ministers that were there. I got to become one of the lieutenants that helped out with the women and the children, and I got to learn a lot of different things. And, of course, they put me right, of course, in the kitchen, and I'm just doing what I knew how to do, and it taught me a lot of different things, taught me how I could actually help finance my own things and doing things and making money. And that was very important to me because when I lived in New York, my mother was here in Asheville, and I got a chance to actually, I didn't have any children, of course, I just graduated from high school. So I got a chance to really build a little foundation there and to be able to increase my knowledge about the world and see things in New York that I'd never seen before and to go places that I've never been before, and it just made me feel so great that I was able to get involved with the Nation of Islam, and it taught me the value of being a beautiful black woman, a complete 360-degree woman, getting knowledge, wisdom, and understanding from a lot of different people that was older than I and that had been out there in the world, and it just taught me and showed me a lot of good things.
And I think this is something that a lot of people don't quite understand or might even be surprised to hear, that the Nation of Islam upheld women and was giving a sense of identity and dignity within the community that was sorely needed because of the messages that the community was receiving from the dominant community outside, white culture.
Yes. Oh, yes, I definitely agree with that.
What about some of the larger, but what about some of the larger politics, too, outside? So within, again, this sense of identity, a sense of self and confidence that comes from being part of that organization and what you're learning and the people you're meeting. What did you make of the politics vis-a-vis white culture and some of the language, burn, baby, burn, that you mentioned earlier, that was coming out at the time? You met Huey Newton, Rap Brown, Stokely Carmichael, all of those figures who are people I think you actually met, right?
I did. I really did. And it was a pleasure to meet them. I had their posters on my wall. I lived with my sister in New York for a while and in Brooklyn. But then I was able to financially help support myself, and I had my own place. So I had a chance to move around a little bit. And fortunately, not having any children at that time, I was able to go and move and see things and get involved with people and learn a lot of different things that was going on. And that got me a chance to meet Malcolm in 65. I was able to meet Malcolm at the Audubon Ballroom and Angela Davis. Sometimes I didn't get a chance to really be around these people a lot, but I got a chance to meet them. I had their posters all over the walls. Of course, back in those days, everybody had posters of Huey Newton and Angela and Stokely Carmichael and all of the big known names, and it made me feel good. And my mother, of course, was always paranoid and afraid that something was going to happen to me because I was with all these dangerous people, mm-hmm. as she called them. But
What did you tell her about that? The fears that she might have that this is the kind of outspoken, you know, behavior that could get you in trouble. What did you say?
Well, I told her. I said, "Well, look, Mama, I'm not doing anything wrong, and I'm just around these people, and unfortunately, they're all in the forefront and in the highlights of these people here, but I'm just a little nobody out here trying to help somebody learn about anybody that can help somebody."
Maybe a little nobody, but it did afford you a trip to Washington, D.C. You met Hubert Humphrey and Robert Kennedy. Tell us about that.
Yes, I did. And at that time, I had had some issues with dentures in my mouth, and I didn't have any teeth, and I felt real bad because I had to speak. And I was always holding my hand over my mouth, you know, trying to talk, and they stopped me one evening and told me that I was not born with teeth, not to worry about that. And they made sure that the meal that they ate was available to me because they actually pureed my food so that I could eat the same thing everybody else ate, and I felt very good about that because now I didn't have to just suffer the consequences. I was a big person, and so I took my hand down from my face, and I was able to talk. And that's, like I said, during the baby burn era where a lot of black people didn't have opportunities, and the nation actually helped bring out my ability to be able to communicate and talk to people. And then when I came back to Asheville from the 70s, I got my radio license to be on the radio, and I've just been walking and talking.
Well, tell us more about that, Ray. Yeah, you need a third-class license to talk on the radio back then. You don't need that. They let people like me talk on the radio without a license these days. But back then, you had to get an FCC license just to talk. So talk more about your work at WBMU FM in Asheville, right?
I did for about 15 years. I was on the radio. I did all kinds of music, jamming and jazz with Hanan Shabazz. I did gospel music, country, western. It doesn't make any difference. There's a message in the music, and it's yours if you choose it. So I was able to share a lot of my wisdom, knowledge, and understanding through music, and it was a pleasure to be able to do that. Sometimes the words in a song can tell a story, and I was able to do that. I think I touched many people's lives, never met any of them sometimes, but then sometimes people would say, "I heard that voice, I know that voice from somewhere," and that was me on the radio. Mm. Sometimes I did poetry, sometimes there was just some things that you could just say to make somebody's day, and that meant a lot to me. I had no idea that I was doing that, but the calls that would come back in and the notices and the words of wisdom that I would share with people meant a lot, because they would come back and let me know that, or send a card or a letter or something and say, "Thank you." And that meant a lot to me.
But you don't get to
see. Still does today.
Well, but you don't get to see your audience when you're on the radio. But you did get to see who is benefiting by your skills at Shabazz Soul Food. Talk about that you and your husband opened on what was then known as the Block in Asheville.
Yes, indeed. That was through the Nation of Islam. The Muslim brothers got together and they wanted to. They sold newspapers and they sold fish. And I, in the Nation of Islam, I learned how to do over 100 things with whiting fish. And I still do that today. And the beans that we also was able to take navy beans and make bean pies out of them. As a matter of fact, I've got pies that I've got to do for Thanksgiving this year. Someone always remembers that I am one of the sisters. I had a lot of sisters in the nation, but a lot of them didn't want to do all the things that I did and that I wanted to do. But they always came back to get some pies or some apple fritters or some whatever it is that I was making. I stayed in the kitchen more than a lot of the sisters did, and I really wish, and even today, there's still a lot of the sisters that are around. They don't partake in the nation on a full-time basis, but they, of course, stop eating pork, and they started eating to live and not live to eat. Mm-hmm. And that has been a pleasure and a blessing for me. I've never weighed over 125 pounds, and I was pregnant at that time. So I've always been a small person with a big appetite and a big heart that I could actually help feed and help somebody else learn something and grow something.
Well, and those folks showed up, and it was a real community gathering space, not just the restaurant, but that whole block. I mean, describe the community around what was known as the block.
Oh, yes. It's a money-making area, and it has changed now tremendously because all those old people that I looked up to back in those days, they would see me running around the corners and up and down the street, beauty parlors, shoeshine parlors. The old guys would be in there playing checkers. And I got the utmost respect even from the elderly men and the women, of course, at that time. If I could help them, I did that. Sometimes I could see some of them, you know, alcohol has always been in all over the world in everybody's life at one time or another. But if I saw somebody that was less fortunate or doing something wrong or getting a little bit too intoxicated, I tried to make sure that they were safe, got them to where they could or found someone in their family to come and get them to protect them from getting harm. But that still means a lot.
Well, we talk about that neighborhood, too, the idea that people could be collected, get to know everybody in the neighborhood and offer that kind of help and that support where the restaurant was. And then urban renewal policies really displaced a lot of those businesses. Talk about the effect on you and about that community and on the community.
Oh, that was the terriblest time in the world. They lied to us so bad. They took everybody's home, basically, and displaced people. And, of course, they said they were going to build more houses and things of that nature. They did not build houses. What they did do was, they promised us that they were going to rebuild and we were going to get houses and things of that nature. You need to get over here. Come on, get it.
You're at the Southside Kitchen now, right? It's noon and you're working.
I'm at the Southside Kitchen right now. Okay. Yes, I am. And somebody's always making noises. And I'm in a room all by myself, and they still coming in here. Close the door, please.
You're never by yourself. You know that.
And I'm never.
Let's talk about the impact. And you said, as they say, urban renewal all across the country was a lie. It ended up displacing a lot of people, privileging a few, and certainly causing some trouble for so many other people. That Asheville has recently talked about reparations. Give us your sense of how you think that's going.
Well, I think that the city of Asheville has said that the city manager has established a short, medium, and a long-term recommendation that the creating a general wealth to the mobility and opportunity in the Black community. And now they've established a community reparation commission that they are trying to give us some kinds of sympathetic progress report, repairing the harm and trauma caused by the public and private, dealing with a lot of racism. Unfortunately, they've also talked about, even today, bringing, letting people have an opportunity to buy dollar lots. They had talked about that at one point in time, and I think that that would be a great thing if they were very sincere about that. They mentioned it at some point in time around here through the city council, but nothing has actually been done about that. And if there were dollar lots available, there are dollar lots that people did buy back in those days, and they built homes on them, on those lots.
Well, I tell you supposed what. To be. I'm going to take a break right now. I want to come back and talk some more about this. I'm up against a break, so we'll stop for here at this moment, and then we're going to continue our conversation with Hanan Shabazz, chef, director at Southside Community Kitchen, culinary mentor at B'nai at Eagle in Asheville, and our conversation continues right after this. Stay tuned. This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Chef Hanan Shabazz, director at Southside Community Kitchen, a culinary mentor at B'nai on Eagle in Asheville. So just before the break, we were talking about the need, you think, for reparations in some way for the city of Asheville and perhaps beyond to actually follow through. How do you, are you confident that it might happen?
Well, I think it will happen. I just don't know exactly how much they're actually going to do. Lies don't care who tell it. So I'm hoping that they're not just lying, because I'd love to be able to help people get dollar lots and be able to utilize this opportunity to build something for themselves and not necessarily have to deal with housing as bad as it is here today. They're talking about increasing minority homeownership and the access to other affordable housing. I don't even really understand how they can actually say they're affordable housing when people don't really have jobs that actually can afford to have a house built. But that is one of the things that is increasing the minority business ownership and having, you know, when we had the block, there was black ownerships from the top of the street to the bottom of the street. And unfortunately, those people didn't have family members that was interested in keeping their legacies going. So we lost out on a whole lot of that. Well, but today it would be good if we, and there are a lot of young black people now that are actually striving towards getting their own businesses.
And you're,
that is a pleasure.
That is, and it's something that you're actually helping with. Talk about the Kitchen Ready program.
Well, the Kitchen Ready program, when Chef Mark Bryan and Chef Lim opened up the opportunity to start a program, the Kitchen Association decided that they needed some help with and this was an opportunity for young people to learn how to do something for themselves, and as well as helping the restaurant association. So we started out with a small group of mostly men, of course, but then I came in one day and I had heard about them, and I said, oh, I need to be over here because I know a little something about the kitchen. So I came into that group and I told them they needed me and I needed them. And we actually got together, and this kitchen has blown up tremendously. From 2000, I think maybe 7 or 8, we started out with a small number. And right now, today, I'm working with 3 of the brothers that came through this Kitchen Ready program. We have this kitchen here now, Southside Kitchen. I work with them every day. Not just these guys that are here in the Southside Kitchen, but there are young men and women all over Asheville that came through this program and still benefiting from the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding that these chefs took the time out to show us and to teach us. My grandmother taught me a lot of things, and the words were different. She would say, parboiling, they call it blanching. So I learned to take the knowledge that she gave me and put it into the knowledge that these chefs brought to my attention, and now we have a fantastic kitchen here. We feed between 300 and 600 people sometimes every day. There's always food available. We get donations in from all over the farmers. It's a blessing to be able to go pick food from the ground and bring it into the kitchen. We have a kitchen here. We have a garden here at the Southside Kitchen. It's a community garden. People can come, work a little bit, get a little bit of food, teach your children, bring your young children in, show them how to bring things from the ground all the way to the table.
And
it makes a big difference.
And to preserve them. I know one of the things you've done with the kitchen and the whole program
yes.
is to teach in canning and pickling and preserving. Talk about that and why you think that's important.
Yes. That is so important. I remember my grandmother and a whole lot of other old ladies and gentlemen having an area in their house where they had canned jars of food that they preserved. Then the freezers came in. So there's a lot of different ways of preserving food, and it means a hell of a lot when you can go down in your basement or go upstairs or look on a shelf and find something that was made last year or year before last, and it's still good today, that you can actually open up a jar and, oh gosh, I have people even today that would love to continue doing this. This virus has everything all messed up mm-hmm. right now because you can't have a lot of people around and things of that nature. But I still get a chance every now and then to get some cabbage and some green tomatoes and onions and make some cha-cha, and it's still good. I have cha-cha all at my house, put the dates and the years on them, and so you know how long you've had it, and it's just good. And then also how you can preserve it and put it in the freezer. And no, I had one of the guys didn't realize that they could take greens and parboil them and save them, put them up in the freezer or in a jar, and you can actually use this much later. I'm here right now today picking some turnip greens. They got the turnips in the front. I'm working on the greens in the back. So there'll be some greens available later on today. If anybody wants some, they're available. It's just amazing how yesterday's wisdom, knowledge, and understanding is still here today. And I thank God that I have the knowledge to be able to learn how to do that and to share it with people.
They do need to know, but talk about the importance of that, because it seems to me that in preserving, I mean, not only do you have the benefit of food that you picked that might have gone to waste, but well beyond that, you create a relationship with the food. That's your food. You remember picking it. You remember how hard it was.
Oh, yes.
And the other thing is the history. You talked about chow chow, for instance, letting people understand where this food came from, whose history it is. You know, that African-American foodways are a very important part of African-American culture and American culture at large. And it seems to me a great way to teach all that is through food, so that the memory, the collective memory, doesn't get lost as well.
Oh, yes. It means a lot to be able to share that knowledge with people that have never had the opportunity. I taught kids, young people here, not just young people, older people that actually wanted to know, and there's still a lot of them that want to know. I really hope and pray that time will come back again soon, to whereas I can't stand for things to be wasted or thrown away, and I feel like that is one of the best ways to preserve your food and to have food. Might not be able to go buy something today, but you can always go to the chef and pick out a jar of beans or corn or okra or something of that nature and feed your family.
Not to mention the fact that Southside community is classified as a food desert, so actually preserving this food is an essential way to keep getting the food, right?
Of course, yes. And I have people all the time, like I said, that the farmers, they actually bring food by. The ladies that glean tomatoes, they bring food by. A lot of things are free. And it bothers me so badly when people say that they don't have anything to eat. Because there's always food. There's always some food somewhere. And if you just take the time to learn, some most people just don't want to take time to learn how to do it. But it's very easy. It's what you need to know. It's how you can preserve your food and eat, regardless of whether you have any cash money in your pocket or not. You can always get something. You can find some potatoes in the ground. They brought a truckload of potatoes by to me. the guys didn't want to take all of them, but they came back again. And, of course, I get out in the street and find people that need food. I get out in the street and share food. They give me boxes of food sometimes. I was getting them every week for a while. Whenever the food becomes available, somebody calls me, and they know that I will make sure that somebody get the food does not get wasted. I cannot stand for food to be wasted. My father had wasted food, he fed his animals so that we could eat ourselves. And that's what means a lot to me.
And you said a lot of people there are some people who don't seem to be interested in learning this, but certainly your family is interested. Your sons are working there. Your grandson's also interested.
Yes.
Are they? Yeah?
Yes. I had a grandson that was in another city in North Carolina, and he was always getting in trouble. And I went down to Charlotte and Winston-Salem, and I got him out of that and brought him back. I said, Judge, if you let me have him, I ain't going to kill him, but if you let me have him, I'm going to teach him some things that he can learn for himself. Mm. And one of the other things is the younger guys that would always come around when I would come home from working, they'd smell food or they'd have some banana bread or something of that nature. So one day I got tired of them talking to me about what I brought, what you bring. I went and got some cutting boards and some knives, and I got those young guys in this cooking class, the Kitchen Ready program, and they are still in that program today. They had babies coming. They kept saying, it ain't my baby. I said, well, it might look like you start feeding it, and come on, let's go out and learn how to do something. So they are in this kitchen right now today. This kitchen and a lot of kitchens all over Asheville and other places. People leave here. They go to another city. They know that they can find something to do if they go and find a job in a kitchen.
Well,
they have done that.
You certainly have a reputation in the Asheville area because one of your important roles was as a culinary mentor at B'nai on Eagle. How did you get involved in that project?
Well, one day I was just one of the chefs had told me they was having a in February, of course, that's Black History Month. And John Fleer had invited me to come to his kitchen, Rhubarb, which is on the square, and fix a soul food meal, some things that maybe Dr. Martin Luther King would have eaten or liked and enjoyed. And I had the pleasure of going to his restaurant and fixing food there. And from that day on, I think my name has just been ringing all over the world. It's been on the radio and it's been on the TV and in the magazines. And I thank God that I was able to share a lot of the wisdom, knowledge, and understanding that I had received from so many different people all over the world, basically. I met a lot of people at his restaurant, a lot of chefs. They know me. I have no idea. Sometimes I walk down the street and I hear my name called. I'm like, who in the world is that? They don't know me here. But then my face is one of those faces, evidently, and people recognize me, and they've enjoyed some food. I've fed them. I've cooked food on the street. I started fixing food in a different neighborhood, got me some propane tank, and get out in the street, and I cook food because a lot of people don't have money, and I'm not going to let them be hungry. Might not get a whole plate, but they can get a piece of chicken and a piece of cornbread or some beans and cornbread or something of that nature. And I thank God that I can just continue. I do this every day, every single day. God lets me get up in the morning, and I thank him for that, and I find something that somebody needs during the course of the day.
Well,
so it's been a pleasure.
The Southern Foodways Alliance is among those who have recognized you. You are the 2020 recipient of their annual Ruth Fertel Keeper of the Flame Award. It celebrates unsung heroes of Southern culinary history and tradition. What's it been like to be honored like that for you?
That has been one of the best things that has ever happened to me, and especially because I am still here. I'm alive. Most of the time, it's been my experience that people wait until you're no longer around. You've done everything you can do. Nobody says thank you. But I thank God that I have been here to witness myself some of the good things that people have actually said about me and my ability to help people. They know that if I get some food or if there's some food around and somebody needs some, I'm going to make sure they get some of that food. Well, and that means a lot to me. I thank God for the man that came all the way here from Mississippi and took the time out to follow me around and watch me. I actually fed him fish burgers. I know how to take fish and make things out of it that they don't even have in restaurants sometimes. But I know how to finagle and put some things together and make them taste good. And this guy came up here from Mississippi, and he did a fantastic job. I'm so grateful for the award that they gave me. I thank God that I'm hoping and praying that somebody else besides my family and all the friends all over, that thing has gone all over the world. California and all other places have been able to see some of the things that I've been able to do, and I'm grateful. Very grateful.
Well, we are grateful to you for sharing your time with us. You're in the kitchen now, so I know you're busy. Thanks so much for talking with us. Congratulations on your award, and maybe you'll share some of those recipes with us, will you?
Well, perhaps I will do that.
Chef Hanan,
I'd love for you to have some of my food as well. That's not a problem. Yeah, hopefully, I'll meet you one day.
When this thing lifts, I'll be at your kitchen door. Chef Hanan Shabazz.
Thank you. Direct, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Southside Community Kitchen culinary mentor, Benet on Eagle in Asheville. You can find out more at our website, stateofthings.org. And just before we go, you might know this already, but I've been the host of the show for about 15 years, and I've got lots of good stories to tell from my time being behind the mic. As you also know, I am about to retire. But if you have been listening long enough, I bet you have stories, too, about stuff you've learned on the State of Things, how the show has mattered to you, perhaps your identity in North Carolina. My last day live on the air is coming up pretty fast, so I want to hear from you with those stories, and we can have a conversation on the air, perhaps record some of those stories and share them with the rest of the audience. Please leave a message for me at 919-980-5419, 919-980-5419. And we're going to have that number at our website, stateofthings.org. Tell me about your fondest memories of the State of Things and what the show has meant to you. That would be a lot of fun. 919-980-5419, number to call to be on the show. My last live one coming up not long. So hoping to hear from you. State of Things produced by Anita Rao, Amanda Magnus, Grant Hollab-Mormon, Kaya Findlay, and Stacia Brown. Elikam Dodor is our intern. Jenny Lawson is our technical director. Al Widarski helped engineer today's show. North Carolina Public Radio is a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.